KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A legislative push to place the Ocheti Chacoin Essential Understandings, or OSEUs, in every South Dakota school has died on the Senate floor. Lawmakers say now is time to change course. South Dakota Public Broadcasting CJ Keene has more.
In what represented a relatively strong push to mandate the program in the state, the proposal was ultimately trounced on the Senate floor on a vote of 7-28. Many of the no's were from lawmakers concerned with potential changes to education and the qualifications of educators to teach these lessons. Lower Buell Republican Senator Tamara Grove said it was a challenge to sit through the vote.
Just being really vulnerable, it was very personal, and you're not supposed to get attached to your bills like that, but I did, and so it was a hard loss. But I'm okay. That kind of compels, it just compels you forward, and so that is why I'm not quitting.
Grove says she believes in the OSEUs and their power to improve state-tribal relations.
My mind was on like the exchange students kind of theory of if you know people from across the waters, right, you're less likely to go to war with them. A big part of the divide in the state of South Dakota is because we don't understand each other. We don't know each other.
That sentiment was echoed by Oglala Lakota Democratic Senator Red Dawn Foster.
If you talk to college students till this day, they will say that they weren't aware that there were 9 tribes within the state's boundaries of South Dakota, and how the state boundaries became a fact, and that the fact that the reservations and tribal nations supersede the state as well as the, federal government. So how can you know your neighbors if you don't know the history?
Grove says she's now working on a non-legislative push via the Department of Education to further incorporate the OSEUs into schooling. I'm SDPB's CJ Keene in Pierre.
Native Americans needing help with addiction and substance abuse have an option opening this month in the town of Sheridan, Oregon. KLCC's Brian Bull reports on the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde's new residential treatment facility.
Turned out just amazing. We did a blessing ceremony on Friday.
With dark wood decor and soothing tones of gray and green, the Main Street Recovery Facility is spacious and calming. Operations Director Jennifer Worth shows where clients will sleep, meet, do chores, and get wraparound services.
Having full access to counseling, group, case management, any other hands-on services that a tribal member may need.
Worth says any Native American 18 or older can be helped here if they are medically stable and beds are available.
Other things we're working on, hopefully adding a sweat lodge in the back.
Kelly Rao is the Executive Director of Tribal Health Services for the Grand Ronde. She says like their opioid recovery clinics in Salem and Portland, the Sheridan facility integrates Western medicine with Native practices.
Culture is medicine for us, making sure that we don't lose sight of who we are as a people and how we want our tribal members, as well as other Natives, to feel that they're part of something bigger and that we're here for them.
The recovery center will be taking a few clients next week. Up to 18 beds are on site in an area adjacent to the Grand Ronde Reservation. Part of a major $6 billion opioid settlement helped fund the Main Street Recovery Facility. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
U.S. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Martin Heinrich have reintroduced legislation for essential veterinary services in tribal communities. The bill authorizes the Indian Health Service to provide services to domestic animals. The legislation aims to address the overpopulation of stray and abandoned dogs in Indian country, which the senators say is a significant public health and safety issue. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the American Indian College Fund, providing millions of dollars of scholarships to Native students every year. Applications are accepted through May 31st at collegefund.org or by phone at 800-766-FUND.
Enbridge strives to be a good steward of the environment, a safe operator of essential energy infrastructure, and a good neighbor. More on Enbridge's Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan at Enbridge.com. Enbridge proudly supports this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
We see the kinds of cuts that are being floated over on the House right now could be devastating to Alaska.
Senator Murkowski reacts to a U.S. House budget that would lead to big Medicaid cuts. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, February 26th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, state lawmakers propose new revenue measures to address a large budget deficit.
We want to get this on the table and start to have a debate about how we're going to close this $536 million deficit.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You can make a difference in the lives of Alaskans. Every year, hundreds of nonprofits provide warm meals, safe places, and resources to hundreds of thousands of Alaskans. By supporting Alaska's nonprofits when you apply for your PFD, you're giving more opportunity, more hope, more chances. This year, make more possible with the click of a button. Don't forget to give via PicClickGive when you apply for your PFD. This message sponsored by PicClickGive.
The U.S. House last night passed a spending blueprint that would extend tax cuts and almost certainly reduce Medicaid, the government insurance program for low-income families, pregnant women, and others. Alaska Congressman Nick Begich, like nearly all Republicans, voted for the House budget. He was not available for an interview today. On the other side of the Capitol, U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski is telling Senate leaders that the House budget cuts to health care programs would hit hard in Alaska, where one of every three residents is insured through Medicaid.
Our assessment of it is that the impact, once again, to Alaska, if we see the kinds of cuts that are being floated over on the House right now, could be devastating to Alaska. So I'm doing my homework on it and getting good, solid numbers, but I'm alerting folks that this could be very problematic for us.
At an entirely different capital, the Alaska State Capitol, lawmakers from both parties said cuts to Medicaid could exacerbate a budget deficit that's already estimated at more than $500 million between this year and next. House Finance Committee co-chair Andy Josephson, an Anchorage Democrat, says Alaska is especially dependent on Medicaid.
We believe that the cut to Alaska, under the numbers best known at this time, would be $1.15 billion, and that as many as 60,000 Alaskans, and I suspect more, would fall off the rolls.
The U.S. House budget does not specifically make cuts to Medicaid, but it instructs the House committee that oversees Medicaid and Medicare to find at least $880 billion to cut. And budget experts say it's impossible to do that without reducing health care coverage. Cuts to Medicaid would require states to make up the difference or reduce coverage for beneficiaries. Murkowski says other spending vulnerable to House budget cuts are the subsidies available through the Affordable Care Act that help families buy health insurance. She says it's costly to have more uninsured people.
What then happens is people are still going to get sick and have babies, and they go to the emergency room, and we're all paying for it. It's not getting any cheaper here.
The House budget calls for total spending cuts of $2 trillion over the next decade. It also calls for tax cuts that would reduce revenues by $4.5 trillion. The only Republican to vote against it, Representative Thomas Massie of Kentucky, said he could not vote for a budget that would increase the deficit by more than $2 trillion. The Senate and House have to agree on a budget resolution, and then congressional committees go to work specifying which cuts to make. And as the state faces an estimated $500 million deficit between this year and the next, Alaska Senate leaders are reviving options for raising revenue. One controversial bill would reduce a state North Slope oil production tax credit by $3 per barrel. It would also prevent oil producers from claiming more in production tax credits than they spend on capital investments in a given year.
It's estimated to raise hundreds of millions of dollars per year. Oil tax credit reform has long been a priority for Anchorage Democratic Senator Bill Willekowski, who pitched the bills during a news conference on Tuesday. He argued they'd likely have little impact on the state's economy.
We want to get this on the table and start to have a debate about how we're going to close this $536 million deficit.
That tax credit proposal was one of several measures proposed by Dunleavy's Department of Revenue Commissioner to a working group of legislators in 2021. The commissioner at the time introduced it as one of the, quote, options the governor would support. But now Dunleavy's press office is walking that back. The governor's communications director, Jeff Turner, now says the commissioner misspoke. Some minority Republicans in the Senate also came out against the bill, including Palmer Senator Shelley Hughes.
I think we should be increasing our tax base rather than increasing taxes. And that will grow our economy. And with the man in the White House right now and the opportunity for new projects, I think it's sending a very bad message.
The state's dire fiscal picture has complicated efforts to boost state funding for public schools, a top priority for leaders of the House and Senate. In the House, leaders are lukewarm on the proposal. House Finance Committee co-chair Andy Josephson, an Anchorage Democrat, says tweaking oil tax credits is not a priority for the largely Democratic multi-party caucus that controls the House.
I would say they should send it over to us and we'll take a look at it, but it's not what we're focused on.
Josephson says House leaders would likely be more receptive to another revenue bill that would assess corporate income taxes on S corporations in the oil and gas industry. That would close what backers call a loophole, allowing privately held Hillcorp to avoid the corporate taxes paid by companies like ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips. That's another proposal that the revenue commissioner said the governor supported back in 2021. But just as with the oil tax credits, the governor's spokesman now says that commissioner misspoke. A group of protesters visited the offices of Alaska's congressional delegation in Fairbanks on Monday. The event was aimed to push back against the Trump administration and has happened in Anchorage almost every week since the inauguration. Participants have dubbed the event Pack the Offices. As Shelby Herbert reports for the Alaska Desk, Fairbanks' first Pack the Offices protest was a well-attended but quiet affair. There were no signs or chants, just a whole lot of paperwork.
What's your name? Taylor. About 50 people stream into the Fairbanks Federal Building, which contains the offices of U.S. Congressman Nick Begich III and Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan. The delegation isn't there, but the staffers are. They're handing out comment worksheets to the protesters, which they fill out on any flat surface they can find, on the office walls, inside water fountain sinks, and even on each other's backs. Among them is Stephanie Shapiro, who just got fired from what she calls her dream job with the National Park Service. She's one of thousands of probationary federal employees across the nation who are indiscriminately purged from their jobs this month.
I loved it. It was the best job ever.
I invested in living in here, and now I'm scrambling to figure out what to do about rent.
Shapiro moved to Fairbanks from Maryland to work with the National Park Service about a year ago. She was 8 weeks away from wrapping up her probationary period when she was fired via email for, quote, poor performance. It was the same letter received by scores of other former federal workers this week.
You know, I never had a poor performance review. I was always rated as exceeding expectations. Being a public servant had taken on a whole new meaning to me, and making sure that every government dollar was accounted for was part of my job. I was measuring efficiency and making sure that everything was buttoned up. And now they have less workers to do that. It doesn't make sense to me.
University of Alaska Fairbanks employee Deanna Lazarus hasn't lost her job, but she's worried about how the Trump administration might impact her ability to do her work effectively. She manages the university's mail center and says she's uneasy after President Trump expressed interest in restructuring the U.S. Postal Service.
Here in Alaska, the Postal Service is very vital to our state, our infrastructure. People get their medications. Some pay still their bills this way. We get what we need. And it to possibly be controlled by the White House, which already controls enough, is scary.
The Fairbanks Pack the Offices protest is modeled after a weekly event hundreds of miles south, where protesters marched through the federal office building in Anchorage. There, the event's original organizers reported that they're happy, albeit surprised, to see the movement spread to Fairbanks. Some in the Fairbanks crowd said they were pleased with Murkowski's statements challenging recent executive actions, but the general sentiment was that they want Alaska's federal delegation to push back harder against the current administration. Here's Kelly Barker, who organized the protest in Fairbanks.
My biggest concern, which covers all my littler concerns, is we have someone in office that is trying to upend everything that our country has stood for, and we need our representatives to step up and change the course of action.
Barker and other organizers said the paperwork blitzes in Alaska's federal offices will continue to happen every Monday evening for as long as people in their respective communities desire, or until they say they receive a satisfactory response from the delegation. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Shelby Herbert.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, middle school basketball teams from remote communities get a rare opportunity to hoop against players their own age.
Back on St. Paul, we have to play against our parents, or we have community members, past players that play against our middle school team.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know 100 years ago, the chances of a baby dying in Alaska before their first birthday was almost 10%? Because of advances in public health like sanitation, access to clean water, vaccines for children, and access to health care in rural communities, the chances of dying are now less than 1%. To learn more about what the Alaska Department of Health is doing to improve Alaskans' health for the next 100 years, visit health.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Influenza or flu cases in Alaska are spiking, according to data from the state's Division of Public Health. Cases have increased dramatically the last 3 weeks, and flu-like illnesses made up about 5% of emergency room visits earlier this month. Joe McLaughlin is the chief epidemiologist for the state. He says this year's flu season has been one of the worst in recent years across the country, and there have been high rates of hospitalization and death.
Fortunately, the influenza rates in Alaska are a little bit lower than what we're seeing in the lower 48, but they're still elevated. In fact, they're at their highest level that they've been at all season, according to our trend data.
McLaughlin says the current rates have almost reached the peak of last year's flu season, but they are still well below the peak 2 years ago. He says it's very difficult to predict from season to season or even month to month what will happen with influenza. And he says we don't yet know why the rates are so high this year.
It could be that influenza vaccination coverage rates are lower than they have been in past seasons. It could be that we're seeing a slightly more virulent strain. The other possibility is that the flu vaccine itself is not as effective this year as it has been in recent years.
He says Alaskans older than 65 and ages 0 to 4 are at the highest risk of severe flu illness, and those with underlying medical conditions. He says Alaskans can protect themselves and others from the flu by washing hands frequently. If you're sick, you should stay home for at least 24 hours after your fever goes down. And he says the flu shot helps prevent transmission and reduces the chance of severe illness for those who get it. The case of a Somali asylum seeker in Alaska who's been caught up in the Trump administration's immigration crackdown has provided a rare look at how immigration proceedings work in the state. 27-year-old Roble Ahmed Salat is one of about a half dozen people immigration and customs enforcement officials have detained in Alaska so far this year, according to reporting by the Anchorage Daily News. Daily News reporter Michelle Terrio-Boots says Salat's journey to Alaska began in 2022, when he crossed the U.S. border with Mexico.
He went through the asylum proceedings process without an attorney and not having full English. He was denied for his asylum claim. But there was a problem. Because Mr. Salad is from Somalia, the government said we can't realistically deport him because right now we don't have relations with Somalia and we don't have assurance that if you deport someone to Somalia, you're not sending them back to a dysfunctional and dangerous place. So they said, you're on this something called supervised release. Check in over a year from now.
So they just gave him like a court date.
Yeah, basically. They gave him a court date. They said, show up in San Antonio, Texas on December 18th, 2024. And so in the interim, Mr. Salad moved to Alaska. He found a job at an Anchorage assisted living facility. He found an apartment. He set up a life here. And he did, in fact, go fly to San Antonio, Texas to do that in-person check-in with his immigration supervision. Fast forward to the Trump administration takes over, and there's a broad immigration crackdown that the president has made a lot of. And there have been no more than about half a dozen people picked up in Alaska since the beginning of the year. Mr. Salad, I believe, was the sixth person.
Gotcha.
And what his attorney argues is that because Mr. Salad is from Somalia, you can't deport him because he's also eligible for something called temporary protected status. There's a list of countries where people are eligible for something called TPS, temporary protected status, which basically means they cannot be deported because their country is too dangerous or unstable for them to go back to. Somalia is on that list, though Trump has been pulling countries off that list quickly. Like Haiti was on that list. It's not anymore. So Mr. Salad, before he was arrested, he applied for this TPS. And that is the crux of the argument of why he cannot be deported, according to his attorneys. Because if he's in the process for this TPS status, they can't kick him out of the country while that's pending. And just a few days ago, a judge agreed that he cannot be deported because he has a potential temporary protected status claim.
And those other folks that we know have been detained, do we know at this point if it's gone beyond that, or that's kind of a mystery because of what you just described?
I don't know for all of them. So there's a few things that could happen. Some people can get bonded out, and I do believe that has happened in a few of the cases, though I'm not precisely sure how many. Or people would be held at the Anchorage jail through that deal that the state has with ICE and then transferred to Tacoma, Washington, generally, which is the main detention center for kind of the Pacific Northwest region for immigration detention. And from there, there are a number of paths, a number of hearings that people would have to have before they would necessarily be deported. And that's kind of where you tend to lose the thread, is when people go into that big secondary place, they're out of Alaska, it becomes really hard to know what's become of them.
You know, we're still just in the second month of the second Trump presidency. And people like this, like Mr. Salad, might seem like low-hanging fruit or something. Like they're on this list. It's easy for ICE to, you know, find this guy that has been ordered deported. But it seems like there's probably more immigrants in Alaska than that, more than that half dozen. Are other people worried, or are the attorneys worried that this is going to grow in scope?
I think there's a tremendous amount of fear and worry and also misinformation, rumors. And I wish I could say with any certainty, oh, this is who ICE is targeting. This is how they're connecting their operations. I don't know that. I don't know that anyone knows that. Nationally, the Trump administration has made a big point of saying that they are trying to deport, quote, the worst first, people with really serious criminal records, violent charges against them. To my reporting so far in Alaska, I have not, and again, this is a small sample size of people. We're talking a half a dozen people, but that has not been the case in Alaska, where people have had serious or violent criminal charges that have been visible to me in the state system. So that's hard to say. I think that one thing to watch is that temporary protected status. People from certain groups that have that status right now, if that status is taken away, that may make people more vulnerable to deportation. And that seems to be changing. All of this seems to be changing almost minute by minute.
That was Anchorage Daily News reporter Michelle Theriault-Boots. You can read her full story about the Trump administration's immigration enforcement in Alaska at ADN.com.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GCI, keeping schools and students connected across the state with a resilient and redundant network. Details at gci.com/education. How does Alaska's land fund community services for Alaskans with behavioral health conditions and developmental disabilities? Through the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. The Trust Land Office manages 1 million acres of lands to maximize revenue generation, with earnings supporting millions of dollars in trust grant making each year to help improve mental health outcomes for beneficiaries statewide. More at alaskamentalhealthtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
Kotzebue's drinking water is again facing issues with manganese levels. As KOTZ's Desiree Hagen reports, a recent manganese advisory is the latest in the community's ongoing water woes.
The city of Kotzebue issued a health advisory Friday for manganese levels in the community's drinking water. The advisory said manganese exceeded levels set by the Environmental Protection Agency for infants under 6 months old over a three-day period last week. The city recommended not giving tap water to infants or mixing water with baby formula, and to consult a doctor about individual health concerns. The city could not immediately be reached for this story, but according to its statement, the treatment plant is not reliably and consistently removing enough manganese, and it would likely take 4 months to resolve the issue. The city issued similar warnings about high manganese levels in 2023, and last May, Kotzebue's manganese levels were the highest on record. Although manganese is important to humans in trace amounts, the EPA says high levels can have lasting health effects. Last month, the city issued an alert that said Kotzebue's drinking water had exceeded the maximum levels for disinfectant byproducts over the last year. Exposure to these chemicals over several years has been linked to liver, kidney, and nervous system problems, as well as an increased risk of cancer. The city said it was working with a water chemist and a lab in Fairbanks to find a solution. Last year, the city council voted to waive residents' water bill during months when manganese levels exceeded EPA standards. The council also asked the city to look into purchasing household water filters, which are expected to arrive in mid-March. Buying bottled water, which is expensive, is one of the only options for people concerned about high levels of manganese. The city discourages residents from boiling water because it can concentrate manganese instead of removing it. In Kotzebue, I'm Desiree Hagen.
The Anchorage School Board voted 6-1 to approve a budget last night that makes $43 million in cuts by eliminating all middle school sports, three high school sports, the Ignite program for gifted students, and increasing the student-to-teacher ratio by 4 for all grade levels. Board member Kelly Lessons said the budget prioritizes student outcomes despite significant cuts to special programs.
I think it's a wise decision, but I'm still not happy about what passage of this budget itself begins and what it represents, because our kids will not be served well by the budget that we have to prepare.
The board is waiting to hear if the legislature and the governor will agree to increase the base student allocation, which would allow them to reverse some of the cuts. Members of the House and Senate are negotiating with Governor Dunleavy's office. The board passed an amendment from Lessons and Carl Jacobs that details how most of the cuts will be reversed if the BSA is increased by $1,000. Jacobs said the workload of administrative positions that were cut from the budget is likely to fall on teachers. The spending plan in the amendment would add over 300 teachers to revert the district's student-to-teacher ratio back to 2016 levels.
Our job is to support all students, and I trust that administration has drafted a budget which we know may not be final, but if it is, this is an attempt to best serve every student with the resources that we are given.
The board heard 6 hours of passionate testimony over the last 3 weeks on nearly every aspect of the proposed budget cuts. Dozens more written comments were submitted ahead of last night's meeting. Unrest continues at Mount Spur, the closest active volcano to Alaska's population centers, and scientists at the Alaska Volcano Observatory are still watching it closely.
We locate these days up to 100 earthquakes per week or even more at the volcano.
Matt Haney is the observatory's scientist in charge. He says the earthquakes are small, but there have been many more than usual since October, when the observatory put Spur on advisory status and its corresponding color code yellow. Over the same time period, Haney says the observatory has also measured the volcano inflating, like a balloon, by about 2.5 inches. But at this point, Spur could go either way, Haney says, with equal chances that it erupts or doesn't. He says longer, sustained shaking called volcanic tremors would tip the odds more in favor of an eruption.
Volcanic tremor is a continuous shaking of the ground that can go on for minutes or tens of minutes, or even perhaps an hour.
Haney says that would likely bump Spur's status from yellow to orange or watch status. Haney says observatory staff are watching Spur around the clock and conducting occasional flights over the volcano to test the gases coming out of its vents. So far, he says they have not seen elevated levels of sulfur, which would be another indication that an eruption is coming. Well, last week, Unalaska's junior high basketball team took on players from St. Paul in 3 days of games. As KUCB's news intern Taylor Heckert reports, a home game like this has not happened in a long time.
It's Wednesday night in the Unalaska High School gym. Family and friends crowd the stands to cheer on players on both sides of the court. The visiting St. Paul Sea Parrots versus the home team Unalaska Raiders. This 3-day event hasn't happened on the island in over a decade. 7 players from St. Paul flew in on a 9-seater plane only half an hour ago. But they're already on the court eager to play, even though it was a last-minute decision.
So Tuesday night they were like, we're coming tomorrow. And then I was like, all right, we figured it out, scrambled, got some refs, and yeah, we're here and we're playing.
That's Kent Russell, the activities director for the Unalaska City School District. The St. Paul players were supposed to go to Dillingham for their Super Cub basketball tournament, but the flight to Anchorage was canceled. They wouldn't make the tournament, so they pivoted. After their superintendent made a few calls, they decided to come to Unalaska.
I talked to a few other people. They don't remember. My wife grew up here. She never played against anybody in junior high. And so I'm not saying there hasn't ever been one, but there hasn't been one in a while.
These games are a big opportunity for both teams to play against someone new. Both island towns are remote. St. Paul is over 240 miles north of the Aleutian Islands. Ethan Candyfire is the coach for the St. Paul team and says there aren't many young players back home.
So back on St. Paul, we have to play against our parents, or we have community members, past players that play against our middle school team. We haven't had a high school team there in a few years, but we've been playing with middle schoolers.
Sixth grader Lula Candyfire agrees. She's been playing basketball her whole life and never played against people her age outside of St. Paul.
It's pretty amazing. It's different, but I like it a lot.
Both teams say that these games are an opportunity to strengthen relationships between their communities while the middle schoolers hone their skills on the court. In Unalaska, I'm Taylor Heckert.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Eric Stone in Juneau, Shelby Herbert in Fairbanks, Rachel Cassandra in Anchorage, Desiree Hagen in Kotzebue, and Taylor Heckert in Unalaska. Our audio engineer tonight is Tobin Shelby. Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Get your weekly look at the trends, policies, and issues that impact your wallet in Alaska with the Alaska Economic Report. From local businesses to fiscal policy to big industries like fishing, tourism, and oil and gas, I'll cover the high-stakes economic issues that matter to Alaskans all over the state. That's the Alaska Economic Report with me, Ava White, on your local public radio station each week.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
Was on my shirt, they gon' be triggered when I wear that. I exposed all the fakes, now who next? Bryson, do not tolerate no disrespect. We went to the White House, they said we got a check, but this truth might make you upset. Donald Trump is your president, if you like it or not. Keep that energy you had with Barack, 'cause you know this Trump train don't stop. Tell Beto to please come try to take my Glock. You wanna impeach him, I guess that's what you do when you can't beat him. I need to dead that, and I'm coming through your hood in my red hat.
to walk you home.
glasses to the stars. My grandma smiling down on me like, ooh, that boy got bars. Okay, okay, yes I do. I said amen and hallelujah, let me testify to another morning, a morning. Won't let self get in my way. I got my breath, I got my faith, and I remember why.
I just want got you to get up. Lately I've been a little fed up. Wish you would just focus on me. Can you focus on me? Baby, can you focus on me? Focus on me. Baby, can you focus on me? Lazy and broke. No, we get this money, so I guess I can't complain. But I feel alone even when we're alone. And that don't cost a thing, but I don't wanna give up. Just want you to get up. Lately I've been a little fed up. A little fed up, yeah. Wish you would just focus on me. Can you focus on me? Ooh, yeah. Baby, can you focus on me? Focus on me, yeah. Baby, can you focus on me? Baby, focus, can't you see? I just wanna love you, baby. Help me in my eyes. Ooh.
Next to me,
guilt is burning, inside I'm hurting. This ain't a feeling I can keep, so blame it on the night. Don't blame it on me, don't blame it on me. Blame it on the night. Don't blame it on me, don't blame it on me. Blame it on the night.
APIA is pleased to announce that our Employment Training and Related Services Division will be traveling to the region in February to share resources and information about workforce development, training, educational scholarship opportunities, the Tribal Vocational Rehabilitation Program, and our child care services. Please stop by and visit our staff in St. Paul February 23rd through March 2nd or contact Kiara Johnson at kiaraj@apiai.org or 907-222-9762 for more information.
This message is brought to you by the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association.